Thank you very much. Later on in my presentation, I shall mention selection bias, and it occurred to me that perhaps this audience, and especially the two preceding speakers, would be biased towards those who think the answer is yes, a paradigm shift is taking place. So I decided, it's a debate, I decided to stimulate debate by trying to convince you that that is not in fact the case. And since the selection bias, I should have asked actually, or we should have asked at the beginning, how many of you would have voted each way before we started the debate, but a paradigm shift is a fundamental change in the basic concepts and practices of a discipline. Thomas Kuhn, who introduced the phrase in the context of scientific advances, contrasted it with normal science, which he defined as scientific work carried out within the context of an existing theory. So, what might we mean by a paradigm shift here? Looking around, and you've seen many examples of that just now, we can certainly see all sorts of changes in data collection tools, access and analysis. The media have coined phrases such as big data, data science, business intelligence, business analytics and so on to describe them, though those phrases mostly lack proper definitions. But digging beneath the media hype and looking at what changes have actually occurred and what changes are currently occurring, I think we can identify three fundamental dimensions. Of these, I think the first is the critical one, and yet it's glossed over by most commentators. This first is the data capture revolution. The process of measurement has been revolutionised. This is true across the board, whether it's a physicist's handheld ruler being replaced by an electronic sensor, a survey sampler's clipboard being replaced by storing the metadata of Google searches and web scraping, sensors in an aircraft engine measuring hundreds of aspects of fuel consumption and vibration every second, or your movements across London being detected by your use of an Oyster card. The point here is that it is now essentially effortless to collect data. Instead of taking a measurement once a day, simply because it was so time-consuming, we take measurements every second, every millisecond, or even more frequently. Automatic, ongoing data capture also opens the possibility of analysing the data as they arrive in real time. And this real-time analysis is my second dimension. Obvious examples are fault detection in aircraft engines and fraud detection in credit card operations. Having the engine sensors in place, that is, collecting the data, is one thing, but having a model for what the sensors are telling us and detecting at the time when performance departs from the norm while the engine is running is where real value is obtained. Likewise, with credit card fraud, while analysis of a massive database of customer transactions can generate models for typical fraud patterns, the crucial thing is the ability to match those patterns to the transactions as they're made. It's no good having a highly accurate credit card fraud detection system which takes 3 months to reach a decision on each transaction. The third dimension is the one which is always mentioned, the data storage revolution. But it's worth noting that while large data sets may be commonplace nowadays, they're certainly not new. The 1910 UK census collected information on 10 questions from 32 million people. Not as large by modern standards, but pretty large nevertheless. Same number as the number of seconds in a year. Over 20 years ago, Walmart collected data from some 7 billion transactions a year, and Mobil Oil aimed to store 70 terabytes of data 20 years ago. So I don't know if the phrase paradigm shift in quantities of data is really appropriate. But following those three fundamental dimensions of change in the data space, there's another activity which just might merit this description. Storing data opens the door to the possibility of repurposing data, of looking at data we've looked at before from new angles. And we can only do this because the data are now automatically being captured and stored. The dimensions I've described, the rate at which data are generated, collected and processed, and the sheer quantity which can be retained, are basic changes, not meriting the description paradigm change. But there are also more subtle and challenging higher-level changes. Perhaps these higher-level changes, consequent on the lower ones, might be described as paradigm shifts, though not so much in the technology as in how data are regarded. So an important example of these sorts of changes is one that's been touched on earlier, the question of ownership. The question isn't so much a new one. but the advent of modern data capture technologies has led to it becoming more critical. So to whom do data belong? Public data might be defined as data which is accessible to the public, not kept in a locked database. Of course, being freely accessible in principle doesn't necessarily mean it's freely accessible in practice, and that is in some sense the entire raison d'etre of the Open Data Institute. But the very act of qualifying data with the word public implies there are other kinds of data. Data which aren't public must be in some sense private. Perhaps this is corporate data that contained within the databases of commercial operations, or perhaps it's personal data, data owned by individuals. Ownership is of importance because the owner has the right to decide what to do with the data, how to use it, who they might permit to use it, and perhaps the ability to sell it. Some data items might legitimately be regarded as mine, my age and height, for example. But perhaps my employer can have as justified a claim to ownership of my salary value as do I. Are my tax records mine or HMRC's? More generally, is the agent which takes the measurement, and so which creates the numerical value representing the empirical attribute, the owner of the datum, or is the person being measured the owner? Every time you make a credit card transaction, around 70 items of information, of data, are recorded, ranging from the value of the transaction, through the nature of the good or service purchased, to the currency, the location in which the transaction took place, and the type of machine on which the transaction was carried out. So who owns the data? It's my transaction, but the credit card operator's vehicle. And it's really the transaction which is being described, not me. But if you put all my last year's credit card transactions together and build a model of how I behave, surely now you really are describing me, talking about me. Conversely, if my age, which is certainly my data, is used in a calculation of the average age of the population, does this mean that the datum average age of the population is partly mine? Questions about the ownership of aggregated data can be even more subtle. For example, in many situations, individual data and aggregate data interact. In choosing medical interventions, in deciding whether a customer is a good risk, in accepting an applicant for a degree course, and for a host of other applications, choices are made by matching data describing the individual to data describing aggregate behaviour. The million past records are used to build a model, and a prediction for you is obtained from that model using your data. But these issues, all of these issues, are old hat, not a paradigm shift. I've mentioned corporations, but the holders of the largest collections of data describing individuals are governments. In this context, the term administrative data is often used, though it applies more widely than just to governments. Administrative data are data collected as a side product of running an organisation. The credit card transaction data I mentioned is administrative data in another context. In government, administrative data include things like tax records, education records, records of local authority interactions, criminal justice records, and so on. As you heard, I'm chair of the Administrative Data Research Network, which is tasked with combining and linking data from government departments to extract value for public policy and social science. In contrast to survey data, administrative data might be described as what people do, not what they say they do. Since administrative data are data exhaust, the side product of some transaction, they're generally cheaper to collect than survey data. Furthermore, since they are necessary for the conduct of a transaction, every transaction produces a record. Now, at first glance, this looks wonderful. The data appear comprehensive, but first impressions can be deceptive. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Some modern data sources go even further in extracting detailed information from people. We've heard about this. As you're all aware, this is particularly the case in web social media context, where people appear willing, as we've just heard, to divulge the most personal of things. It raises a question of whether the notion of privacy is changing, and that might be a question for a future foundation debate. That might constitute some sort of paradigm shift, but it's one of human behaviour, not of data per se. The general public appear to believe that data are shared easily between government departments, that there is perhaps a giant database containing all your details, or their details. This, however, is not the case, and while this might be reassuring from a privacy perspective for those with concerns about excessive state intrusion, it also undoubtedly leads to inefficiencies. these might have implications at the personal level when the left hand might not know what the right hand is doing, but they can also be at the public policy and social level. As many in this audience will know, there's been much discussion about introducing various legislative changes here to help reduce fraud, to make life easier for citizens, and also to enable proper scientific investigations of social questions and public policy. Incidents like the care.data confusion haven't helped public understanding. In fact, a resolution which permits people to opt out or requires them to opt in could easily render the data of limited value. And I'm going to say more about that in a second. But before I do, recall that I mentioned the possibility of selling data. So this raises another high-level question. What are the data worth? Should I receive a small payment every time my data are used? Perhaps when my data is used in a statistical analysis, for example, to construct a credit scorecard or build an epidemiological model of illness, I should be paid. After all, big internet companies such as Google and Facebook make huge sums of money as a result of data freely given to them. But this, again, is hardly a paradigm shift. Indeed, one might even go so far as to say it's nothing new. Think of insurance companies. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story of the man who complained about the way he'd been treated by Google, criticising the way they handled their customers. Then he was asked if he paid Google when he used it to search the web. Of course, he didn't. In that case, he was told, you're not their customer. Their customers are the organisations which pay them for a service, to place advertisements, for example. From Google's perspective, you're the raw material. To take an analogy, if instead of Google we were talking about a hamburger joint, then you would not be the customer, you would be the cow. But this isn't really new. The example of credit scoring agencies springs to mind. Their customers are the people who buy, that is, pay for, the credit ratings and reports on people who want to borrow money, not the people seeking loans. Those people, again, are merely the raw material. Indeed, any enterprise driven by the business model of advertising, such as commercial television, is like this. From their perspective, the programmes we all switch on to watch are gaps between the products these organisations are in the business of selling. So I've spoken about using data and selling it, but that raises a further issue. Unlike goods and services, you can sell a data set and even lose it or have it stolen while still keeping it. For data, you really can have your cake and eat it. Other forms of intellectual property, such as recorded music and written text, have the same sorts of issues. So this property also probably doesn't constitute a paradigm shift. So I've raised several questions which typically aren't questions which had importance until the advent of massive data capture and storage capabilities. But that doesn't mean they didn't exist, or that they are fundamentally different kind of opportunity or exercise. It doesn't mean they represent a paradigm shift. Clive Humby once famously said, data are the new oil, a soundbite which has been repeated often by many times by others, mostly without attribution. And one way in which data are like oil is the fact that judicious use of appropriate data can make you fearfully rich, as Larry Page and Sergey Brin can attest. But as I've just noted, unlike oil, data can be given away or sold many times without leaving your database. But you can go even further than that. You can analyse data again and again in many different ways without in any way using it up. This fact is one of the drivers behind the abundance of database startups. Many of them are based on repurposing data. The data may be collected and analysed with one aim in mind, but then new uses are found, new discoveries within the data, or new discoveries when linking the data to other data sets or applied to different problems. This repurposing, though, again, is not exactly a paradigm shift. It is a huge opportunity, though. It does have tremendous promise for social and economic advance. The data capture revolution and the data storage revolution are certainly posing new problems, requiring the development of new analytic tools, such as online real-time analyses and software tools for parallel analysis of massive data sets. But these are very much within the existing paradigm. They don't represent a paradigm shift. Some people have claimed that the shift from theory-based models to data-driven models is a paradigm shift. The first type are based on some sort of conceptual understanding or at least beliefs about the process underlying the data generation. while the latter are based purely on observation of relationships, correlations in the data, what the data actually say, if you like. But this is nothing new. Statisticians have used data-driven models since the early days of statistics. The use of purely data-driven models in retail credit scoring, dating back to the 1960s, has been a huge practical success, but it's old hat, and in no sense a consequence of the current big data revolution. It's certainly not a paradigm shift. Data quality has always been a key issue for all data analyses. Statisticians used to have a saying that 90% of the work was cleaning the data, with 10% devoted to real analysis. This situation has been materially aggravated in the modern data era. Aggravated with new challenges, but again, hardly a paradigm shift. It's really more of the same with occasional new aspects. So, for example, when I was training to be a statistician, one of the first things I was taught was to familiarise myself with the data, to look at it this way, look at it that way, look for peculiarities, sense check it, and so on. And that's perfectly feasible with 100 data points, it was a long time ago, or 1,000 data points, but it's not feasible with a million or a billion. And it's certainly not feasible if the data are arriving every microsecond. In such situations, the computer is a necessary intermediary between you and the data. The computer is the tool, and tools can be broken or go wrong in other ways. While you might devise checks for every possible fault in the data that you can think of, you can't devise checks for every possible fault there is. But this was always the case. Even when one could eyeball the data, one couldn't think of every possible peculiarity which might arise. So new challenges, yes, but not a paradigm shift. A particularly pernicious example of data quality problems is that of selection bias. So I've had startup companies excitedly tell me about their software product producing results based on analysing all the data so that it wasn't susceptible to sampling error, until it was pointed out to them that all of their data was only the data of those people who had previously chosen to become customers. It could be wildly misrepresentative of those people the company wanted to recruit as customers. If people have freedom of choice about whether or not to allow their data to be included in a database, then the database might be of very limited value. By definition, those who permit their data to be included are different from those who don't. And just last week, an academic told me how he could describe the behaviour of the world's population, because he had interaction metadata from a major social media platform on 10% of the world's population. It's quite awesome. But he missed the point that this was, of course, the richest 10% biased towards younger people. And worse, that the behaviour he was capturing would have changed dramatically within a year or two. In fact, just to drive home the intrinsic non-stationarity of much of the data we now deal with, consider that Facebook is just 12 years old, Twitter's 10 years old, Instagram 6 years old, and Snapchat is 5 years old. Twitter's share price launched at $42 in 2013, but it sunk to just $17 in April this year. Some of you may know about Bebo. Bebo launched in January 2005 and sold to AOL just 3 years later for $850 million. This is something we can all dream of replicating. But in May 2013, a few years later, it voluntarily filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, and in July of that year, the original founders bought it back for just $1 million. The rate of change is extraordinary. Questions of data quality and the suitability of the data for answering questions are tougher than ever, even to the extent that I predict some major miscalculations based on fairly elementary misunderstandings of what data are actually recorded. But faster isn't different. Poor quality data aren't new. Selection bias is a well-established problem. These things don't constitute a paradigm shift. So is a paradigm shift taking place? My overall conclusion, at least for the purposes of this evening, has to be no. The changes are dramatic and exciting, even in some contexts, frightening. It's certainly difficult to see what will happen next in data technology. But what we are seeing is more and faster old rather than qualitative new. Advances in data technology don't require us to throw out the old, as a paradigm shift would. Rather, they build on top of it and extend it. Thank you.